Hello, you are listening to a very special unsupervised edition.
Can you believe they trust us?
I really can't, but I am grateful that we're back together because there is some big news. So I'm Shireen Gourbani on the left.
I'm John Dougal on the right.
And we have so much news to cover. Let's dive right in. So I'm curious where we land in terms of, I know sometimes our politics overlap when it comes to what we're seeing, for example, in Iran, but give me your take on what's going on.
So I done an interview a little over about a week and a half ago, and one of the things I was asked is predictions about Iran, and I said, we're going to war, and I didn't expect it to happen within 12 hours of my comments. It's something that I think is predictable. It's one of those things, you know, some will say we've been at war for 47 years, but we've had, clearly going back to the Carter administration, the challenges and issues with Iran and the attacks they've provoked, either directly or through their proxies in the Middle East. But it's one of those things. It's from my perspective, I'm very cautious and concerned with, you know, decades of presidential power getting us into wars without congressional oversight. My biggest complaint is Congress should be engaged. Congress should be determining when we go to war. I'm one that believes that a president can take defensive action to protect the nation. So maybe there's some defensive justification, but a lot of the comments that have come out don't show that defensive justification. I hear regime change, other things like that, which then causes me to have concern to say, Congress, you should step up and you should do your job. Yeah. If we're going to be at war, declare war. If we're not, so be it. But Congress, be engaged.
Yeah, be engaged. Well, we very much agree there. I think this is horrific. It's obviously complicated for a lot of Iranians who were not fans of Khomeini. And now we're seeing, and I think sort of predictably, listening to Trump kind of ramble through who he thought could be the successor. And then another reporter a few hours later asks about it. And he says, oh, well, that guy's dead and that guy's dead. And so now what we're seeing is the emergence of Khomeini's son, Mojtaba Khomeini, who is a hardliner. So the people of Iran are back under the same kind of regime that they were under just a week and a half ago, right? And I don't see any real care for what the Iranian people are experiencing, the suffering that people are experiencing, the crackdown of the government killing thousands of Iranians just mm-hmm. recently. That's not new for them.
And but the president said he was going to go in to protect
the people, which is just absolute fallacy. So that on top of this kind of all being about oil again, right? I mean, we got into this mess in what, 1953 around oil? We just continue to not learn our lesson around this. And I'm just really interested to see, actually, I will say what one thing that I'm curious about and what would love to hear you talk about is the fracturing on the right. I mean, this is a president who told us no new wars. We had people on the right telling us, if you elect Kamala Harris, we're going to war with Iran. Here we are.
Yeah. Well, and this is where the MAGA crowd is splitting and they're highly conflicted because this was the peace president. He condemned those in the past about endless wars in the Middle East and not taking the nation into war. You rightly mentioned about, you know, fears of Kamala Harris. And so some MAGA folks are like, well, wait a second. You sold us a bill of goods. And others are trying to rationalize, well, this is already a war and he's just ending this war of 47 years because all these other presidents, whether it's the Bushes, whether it's Obama, et cetera, did not get us out of this.
Yeah.
And one of the concerns that I have is too often, and we talked ever so briefly about this right before we came on air, it's the claiming victory. You know, I think back to George W. Bush and Mission Accomplished, when Mission Accomplished was not. But I had this neighbor who was a former elected official, and this was early on, right as I got elected in the state house, so this is over 20 years ago. He said, never read your press clippings while you're in office. Only read them 20 years after the fact, and then you can look back to judge whether or not your actions were good and appropriate and whether you did well.
Yeah. Well, so some horrific news. Obviously, we're seeing streets on fire. The oil is raining from the skies, from the bombings that are happening. A video shows a U.S. missile struck an Iranian girl's school.
And you're being serious. I heard a news report that it would rain oil.
Yeah, I'm being serious. Yeah. Killing 175 children. We're also talking about 7 Americans dead at this point in this conflict.
I think we're up to 8, unfortunately. But yeah.
that Trump incredibly sort of announced to the nation in a rambling sidebar and just sort of said, this is, you know, this is what happens when we engage in war. We're seeing oil surge past $110 a barrel. Certainly
the price at the pumps are jumping 50 cents a gallon.
Yeah.
But you're seeing this weird kind of coalescence of other countries in the Middle East who were kind of, I would say, neutral or maybe somewhat supporting Iran that are now getting attacked by Iran. And now they're coalescing, I think, more with the U.S. to say, you know, why are you attacking us? This is reckless. This is irresponsible. And yeah. They're siding with the U.S. that Iran is being reckless.
Well, and so this creates, right, when we think about the region, we've been talking a lot about Israel and what's been happening in Palestine, you know, as many Gazans have been. So when we think about the region, I think this just increases destabilization and it makes it harder, I think, for people to defend Israel. Tell me what you're thinking on that front.
I think there's skepticism. I mean, clearly there's lots of Americans who fully back Israel and have seen how they've been attacked over the decades. I think there's others that are kind of skeptical right now, thinking Netanyahu led Trump into the war and is pushing Trump to engage in things that normally he wouldn't. Yeah. And so there's some concerns, especially from some of the MAGA crowd, of does Israel have too much control in what the president's doing right now? The president's always quick, once that gets reported, to jump out and say, oh, no, I'm driving this. I'll decide this.
Yeah. So what we're talking about is $1 billion a day. So I just have to note that price tag. So the next time I hear that we can't have childcare, we can't feed the hungry in this country, we can't, frankly, take care of our veterans in this country, we're spending $1 billion a day on a war of choice. And it is absolutely reprehensible to me. I want to jump to
Congress.
Well,
this is one of those things.
Okay, yeah.
War of choice or is it truly defensive? And that's where I would say the jury is out. I could see the argument that it truly is defensive given some of the past history.
Yeah.
But I will note the Iran will have a nuclear weapon or will have these, you know, ballistic weapons within 2 more weeks has been something that has repeated many times.
Yeah.
And maybe that's the case and maybe that's not the case. I don't have that information. But clearly they've been dangerous. Now I do find it ironic that we're now looking to Ukraine to see if they'll supply some military weapons to us, some drones in this war.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I think back to a place where we know we are largely aligned. For me, I would just have to say embarrassing, disgraceful to see Blake Moore say that it would be irresponsible to tie Trump's hands. I feel like this is a full abdication of power of Congress. I was remembering Mike Lee feeling pretty strongly that I think it was Obama needed to come and get the Congress's approval to engage in acts such as these. He seems largely silent. Really haven't heard that much from others. I called Blake Moore's office, and I have to say the person who answered the phone could not give me an excuse for why this was happening and seemed pretty exasperated. Tell me what you think.
This has been one of my complaints for decades, that Congress in the Constitution is the one that has the power to declare war.
Yeah.
And they've abdicated that. You look at decades. I mean, this is going back to, you know, shortly after we got out of World War II. You can talk about, you know, whether it's Korean War, Vietnam, rolling forward from there. Where's Congress? They're largely absent when it comes to declaring, you know, wars or something related with that, AUMF type activities, type declarations.
Yeah.
And presidents have said, well, we've got this War Power Act. And I think it was first when it was passed, Nixon complained that he thought it was unconstitutional that presidents had to come report to Congress and so forth. We talk about the Gang of Eight, everything else like that. But from my perspective, the proper role under the Constitution, the president's there to defend the nation, but when it comes to offensive activity, this is where Congress should be engaged, and both parties have been derelict in granting more and more power, especially war power, to the presidents over the decades and not taking responsibility. I think the founders wanted many folks making the decision whether we're going to war, didn't want to leave it in the hands of one individual, regardless. I don't care what party that is.
I really agree with you there. Well, speaking of responsibility or maybe accountability, it seems chickens have come home to roost a little bit for Kristi Noem, who is no longer our...
Oh, you don't want to talk about Cuba first?
Well, okay.
Well, we got Venezuela and what's going on there. And then we've got Cuba and they're kind of, because of Venezuelan oil, we're blocking that.
Yeah.
They're really suffering economically. And so the question is, what's going to happen with Cuba?
Right.
And I'm hearing rumblings that we might reach out with some type of economic deal with them. to try and bring peace to our issues with Cuba.
So no new wars. we're going to try diplomacy, perhaps, there. I read this interesting article
about
in the Atlantic.
All the things Marco Rubio has to do these days.
Yeah, right. So I read this piece in the Atlantic that was talking about how people in power, in such as Trump is experiencing, is kind of this delusion around victory, right? And the article is called Operational Excellence, Strategic, like, basically bumbling, right? And the notion is that we really are seeing incredible work from our military, which is unparalleled on the face of this planet, right? So the success that you see in Venezuela, the success that we've seen in other places, that is because of our operational excellence. But what we have is no strategy. And I'm really concerned about a president who feels that victory is his under any circumstances, continuing to get us into these debacles. But really, Christy, really quickly, let's talk about Kristi Noem. So Kristi Noem has been fired as the director of Homeland Security.
I thought she was promoted to a position nobody's ever heard of.
I think that is true. And then it looks like they announced it and it was wildly just thin, I would say, as the shield of the Americas. So the joke on the left has been that she is deporting herself to South America. The suggested replacement here is Senator Markwayne Mullen, who I believe is a professional wrestler who's come into Congress,
out of Oklahoma,
does not have extensive experience running any large-scale operation, any large-scale organization. And Homeland Security is huge. It's massive.
Not just ICE and border control. It's TSA and so forth.
Yeah.
Secret Service.
So give me your sense on what happened to Kristi Noem.
I think Kristi Noem, at the end of the day, embarrassed the president. And that was the key thing. Her congressional testimony and other things like that, it got to the point where I think the final straw was where there was the $220 million advertising campaign that she said the president had approved.
Yeah.
And the president said, I didn't approve that. That was the final straw. It was not the other things that were at play.
Not the murder of American citizens.
Well, not her actions on immigration or other things like that. And maybe not even the commercials themselves. But as soon as she tried to throw the president under the bus, I think that was where the president said, nope.
So there are still consequences. Some would say justice for Cricket, the dog she shot in the face. Let's take a break and let's go take a closer look at what happened at the end of our legislative session. Does that sound okay?
Sure.
So I am Shireen Gorbani.
And I'm John Dougal.
And you're listening to Both Sides of the Aisle.
We're unsupervised.
You're listening to Both Sides of the Aisle on Utah Public Radio. We love to hear from listeners like you. If you would like to send us a comment, email BSOTAPodcast@gmail.com. That's BSOTAPodcast@gmail.com. Thanks for listening. Shireen Gorbani on the left.
John Dougal on the right. And we are unsupervised today. It's great to be with you, Shireen.
Always good to be with you. So there's some big news.
Yeah, one of the shocking pieces is I will describe that after the district judge gerrymandered the congressional
Cute.
Maps.
I see what you did.
There has been a question, who's going to run and who's not? Because you have four Republicans with three Republican-leaning seats in this new map. And so Congressman Burgess Owens announced that he was going to retire.
Yeah.
So that kind of cleans the slate a little bit for, three running for those three seats.
Yes. Now, I also saw that a character, an individual that comes up, I would say more often than we would think on this show, Phil Lyman is going to get in the mix here in...
For the third congressional seat. Which basically runs down eastern Utah and takes in the southern half of the state.
Yeah. So it's a reconfiguration. So we're talking about Washington County all the way over to...
San Juan County.
And then coming up
to the basin.
Yeah, yep. a large swath of the estate that, not a huge population, but certainly pretty right-leaning. How do you think that shakes out?
I think somebody told me it might even be R+45, which would make it the most Republican-leaning seat in the nation, if that's true.
Wow. Okay. Well, we'll see how things develop there.
Yeah. So that will be interesting. And some folks are concerned that because of this map, we might end up with, on the left and the right, some folks who go back to Congress who are there for attention rather than actually move policy.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. I think that's the unfortunate byproduct of gerrymandering.
Unfortunately, it seems like too often the norm across the nation.
Yeah.
But we're watching the redistricting battles in all sorts of places.
In all sorts of places. Yeah, it was really, I will say, just a really interesting results in Texas in their elections last week, where we saw Jasmine Crockett and James Tallarico going for the Senate seat there. Tallarico won that. But something that I thought was interesting was the race, and I don't even know who beat him, but Dan Crenshaw, who was, I would say, a person who seemed to be quite MAGA, quite right to me, absolutely getting trounced in his bid for re-election and being bested by a further right individual, a more MAGA individual.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I'd heard a lot of complaints about him over the years, and so it was interesting to see what it would shake out. I think the seat to watch clearly is the Senate seat there. You've got John Cornyn.
Yeah.
Cornyn is the current sitting senator being challenged by the Attorney General, Ken Paxton.
Yeah.
And so I think, you know, folks are going to side with Cornyn because Paxton has so much baggage.
Oh, yeah.
That against Tallarico, they think he's going to lose there.
Yeah.
And I think if it's Cornyn, it's kind of, you know, easy sailing,
yeah,
if you will, relatively.
Compared to the baggage that Paxton brings, certainly. Yeah. Well, okay, shifting away from Texas and back to our own state, talk to me about how you would characterize this legislative session that has now come to an end.
Well, I will tell you that the governor said it was his favorite session of these 14 years that he's been governor and lieutenant governor and so forth.
And did he say why?
I did not see why he said why, but it was clearly a lively session, lots of things going back and forth.
Yeah.
I mean, I think with any legislative session, there were some highs, there were some lows, there were some things that caused people concern that didn't get passed in the end of the day, got left on the cutting room floor. And I always told folks, never judge the legislative session by what goes in, only judge it by what comes out.
Yeah.
Because anybody can open a bill on any topic, that doesn't mean it's going to pass. And you have to just judge by what was the actual work product that got accomplished,
yeah,
to see whether you appreciate it or not.
So it's interesting to hear that Cox said that this was, you know, one of his favorites or his favorite. Lawmakers considered a record high 1,015 pieces of legislation. Amazing, coming from a body that likes to represent itself as small government.
Yeah. In the House, they cleared over, you know, they opened over 600 bills.
Yeah.
Introduced. So
541 of them passed. And they also enacted the budget that will spend more than $31 billion.
And the budget is the key purpose for the legislature. That is their top priority in any session, is to pass a budget.
Yeah, that's right. So a couple of things that stood out to you, or anything you would bring to the attention of the listeners?
I think one of the key things is the budget was larger. So it's growing, even though there were concerns about what kind of revenue would be there. I always appreciate a tax cut. And so they did a modest cut on the income tax. And as the original House sponsor of our current income tax system, I had wanted to get the compromise back in the day was at 5%, and they've got it down to, I think it's 4.45 is what they passed.
Yeah.
So, but it's getting down to where I was trying to get it when I was first running the bill.
Mm, interesting. So I know that we're spending quite a bit on prisons. That's a big ticket item in the work that was, you know, moving through, certainly in the budget. I have to say, a lot of the what I would actually describe as sort of most upsetting, and for me, you know, personally, morally reprehensible efforts to make this an incredibly hostile state for immigrants did not pass. They ultimately did not make it through. It was good to see people really standing up, and Republicans really standing up and saying, is this who we are? You know, there are certainly some in that body who would like to see this be an incredibly hostile state for immigrants, but the majority were not there. And I do think that that is something that brought me a little bit of hope.
Mm-hmm. A lot of folks talk about the Utah Compromise when it comes to immigration, and this is put in place, you know, this was adopted by a lot of organizations and individuals in the state back when I was in the legislature and when immigration issues were fast and furious back then.
Yeah. So,
in fact, I sponsored one of the bills that this session considered repealing and didn't, but it was to allow Utahns to sponsor guest workers in Utah.
Yeah.
I think that is one of the responsible ways to promote more legal immigration, where folks are responsible to ensure that they don't become dependents on the welfare state and so forth.
Yeah. So we also saw, I would say, just really irrevocable changes to our court system that are very concerning to me. The notion that we're going to have potentially this constitutional court. Right now, we have this 3-judge panel. This was a mess. Lawmakers had to go back and address some things that they had left out, I would say, important things of the legislation. But I'm really concerned that now we have a changed judicial landscape in our state that will impact Utahns for generations to come.
Well, unfortunately, I think the courts had some problems that, for whatever reasons, the courts did not address. And I always tell folks, the legislature will weigh in and fix the problems, even the problems you didn't know that you had.
Yeah. Well, and they packed the Supreme Court.
And there were, you know, certain things that I think the legislature changed that were, you and I probably disagree in terms of the 3-panel judge. I think that has potential to be really good, to take certain issues and put it in front of multiple judges rather than just a single judge. But this is one of those that's going to shake out over time to see to what extent does that benefit the judiciary and to what extent does it cause other weakening of the judiciary.
So Cox also rushed to sign a GOP bid to sink Prop 4 signature removal efforts. So this was really something that I would say makes it harder for people to engage in our government. I don't know. What's your take on it?
Well, this is one of those things. You cannot entice one to remove their signature. And it got into the debate of what did it mean to be enticed, and does sending a pre-stamped envelope to somebody to fill out the form and mail it back, is that a form of enticement or not? And, mm-hmm. and the legislature said, we do not want to have people, you know, benefiting from that in terms of the process. And so they basically excluded that. You can put a stamp yourself on it and send it back if you want, but no, somebody can't pay for the stamp for you.
Yeah. The other thing that I noticed was that Utah taxpayers will fund a $100,000 mail-in voting security study after another effort to restrict vote by mail failed. What do you think about that?
Well, I'm one of those. I've historically been a fan of voting in person. I think there are ways to improve and strengthen that. I think, yeah, we all want just citizens voting. There are the occasional token non-citizens that get registered to vote. A study I saw in Utah, revealed
one was registered and that individual had not voted.
In other states, I think you get the occasional voting. So this is not a massive problem that's changing the outcome of elections.
Yeah.
I think we all want trust in the elections, and I've seen too many on both sides of the aisle. Rather than focusing on strengthening the elections, focus on condemning the elections.
Yeah.
And that undercuts any kind of trust in the elections. We should take steps. I don't know to what extent this will really engender more trust in the election.
Yeah.
But we need to be always walking down a path to say, how do we bring greater transparency and greater trust in our election process?
Yeah, I feel like this is setting $100,000 on fire. I mean, it feels to me like there could be certainly better and higher uses given the audits that we've had, the investigations that we've had, and what it's turned up in Utah. And I'm really with you on this. I would love to see ways that we're creating greater access with good security. And this does not feel like that to me. Is there anything else that stood out to you from the session that you want to make sure people know about?
Well, I always tell folks, it gets fast and furious in the last days of the session, especially on the last day.
Especially in the last minute this year.
And sometimes things get passed that legislators don't expect. And Utah's one of those odd states. I think it's good, but we didn't celebrate President's Day. We celebrated Washington and Lincoln Day. We didn't celebrate all the other presidents. And then there was a last minute amendment at about 3:30 on the last day to change that to President's Day. And I think a lot of the legislators woke up on the day after or on Monday going, wait a second, we did what?
Yeah. So now we get to celebrate. If
we get to celebrate Joe Biden and Bill Clinton.
Yeah, there you go.
All those, Jimmy Carter.
Well, one last thing that caught my attention was a vote that actually did happen after the stroke of midnight. So I think it will be TBD what happens with this, but it was the bill to split Salt Lake County. And it did receive its final votes in support after midnight. So what's going to happen?
After midnight? Because usually the clerks stand up and call time out and time's over.
So. That is what is being widely reported. The clock says 12 o'clock, which is technically the next day. So those votes came in, those last couple of votes came in, I think 5 seconds late. So it'll be interesting to see what happens with all of that. But
there used to be the days when they would supposedly drape the clock so you couldn't actually see it. So if you didn't see it, it wasn't really midnight.
Okay.
And since
not
then,
anymore.
Since then, you know, we've been very militant. Midnight's midnight.
Yeah. So this is actually a great time for you to take a moment, go find out who your representatives are. I still think we've got a great website, le.utah.gov. You can check out the folks that represented you, what kind of legislation they brought forward this year. You can find out if they're going to be on the ballot again this year. We know that, you know, we're heading into an election year. And if
we've got caucus meetings coming up. I don't know when the Democrats are, but the Republicans is March 17th.
It's a great time to get involved, to make sure your voice is heard, and to make sure that those representing you and our legislature really represent your values and things that matter to you. So I'm Shireen Corbani on the left.
I'm John Dougal on the right.
And you have been listening to Both Sides of the Aisle. Our producer is Anthony Scoma. Thank you so much for listening. Hey, listeners, this episode will be available shortly at upr.org and wherever you get your podcasts.